This is the Medicast, March 31st, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to episode 111. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's podcast. I am back from going down to Baltimore and checking out EMS Today. The expo conference was fantastic. If you want a play-by-play, blow-by-blow rundown, I urge you to head over and check out Rick Rosati's podcast over at mitigationjournal.com. There's a link in the show notes, and over at the Medicast site, you'll find out a whole lot more about what went on there. Rick did daily updates over the last week while he was down there. He went down for the pre-conference educational seminars and stuck around and took part in a whole bunch of other stuff. I also met up with him while I was down there, and also with Dan White from Alliance Medical at allmed.net. And we all had a great time and caught up on all of the exciting things that have been going on with EMS. And I'll have more to talk about that a little bit later on in the show here. First off, I want to welcome everybody to the show. If you're a brand new listener to the Medicast, I urge you to head over to medicast.com, and you'll find links there for the show notes for the Medicast blog at medicast.com/blog. And you can find show notes, links to everything that I talk about in this and every other podcast all over at the Medicast site. Check it out, look at the back podcasts, and get a sense of what this community is all about. And of course, for the rest of you, those members of the Medicast community that have been around for a long time, thank you again for all of your comments, your questions, your suggestions, everything that you've done to make this Medicast community what it is today. I'll lead off the listener email segment of the show with a quick look at a comment that popped up on the Medicast blog, and it's from listener Rhonda, who's from Edmonton, Alberta, and she is an EMS student, a paramedic student, who is driving back and forth to school and using the Medicast content as a way to study. And I'll tell you very much, thank you for your comments, Rhonda. And she also wants to say thank you to everybody else that has contributed to helping her study on the road. All of the people that have chimed in with their questions via the email source here, as well as all of the people that have helped support the site and all of the various ways, and the people that have interviewed. There's a great community effort here, and Rhonda, you're part of that community now, so I want you to participate. I want you to plan on sending in questions, comments, suggestions. All of that is part of your job here at the Medicast community, and I wish you success in your future studies. Please, please keep in touch and let me know how you're doing in your progress. I also got an email from listener Wesley, and Wesley was asking a question, wanted to know where I get the information and how I pick up news from the web and where I find all of that stuff. And so he has a couple of other questions about skill sheets and things like that. Also a question about EMS Live. So to bring it all together here in one quick source, first of all, Wesley, as always, you can always find the direct links to a specific news article over at the Medicast website, and that's at medicast.com/blog. Now, the medicast.com main page has links to that blog page as well. It also has links to the nursing show, the Medicast news, the Medicast extra. It's a landing page for everything here at the Medicast network. But if you want to find the show notes, you can go over to the medicast.com/blog, and you will find the category there in the left-hand column. Click on podcast, and that'll get you all the show notes for all the episodes. And you can find the episode you've listened to in that format, and then go ahead and find the link to the specific show you're talking about. Now, what about generally? Where do I find this information? Well, I have Yahoo set up. I have a My Yahoo page that will allow you to add RSS feeds. So I go to news sites and different sources and create searches for terms like EMT, paramedic, EMS, ambulance, all of those things. And that creates one source of finding news. I also use sites like MedicineNet, medicalnewstoday.com. All of these sites are great resources, as well as emsresponder.com and gems.com are some of the primary places I go and look for EMS-related news. So those are the primary sources for news items. Where's the other best source for news items? Well, it comes in from listeners like yourself. If you find something in your searches, don't just assume I found it. Send me a link here to podmedic@mac.com and let me know something that you found. In fact, if you'd like to write a little commentary about the article and are willing to send that in to me, I will possibly put that commentary along with the link up on my blog. Now, I won't name you specifically. I'll just, you know, use your first name as I usually do, but it gives me an opportunity to share your commentary and what you're looking at and what your thoughts are as well. So that's just a quick follow-up there. As well as looking at EMS Live, well, EMS Live is alive and well. I will have an interview shortly with John Bignell in the next couple of weeks, hopefully. And I've already talked with him. The interview's recorded. I just have to find some time to get it on the show. And John is looking forward to reopening the EMS Live audio show. And it may be a little bit changed in its format and may be slightly different in some ways, but hopefully it will be back and ready to go online. So keep in touch. You can also head over to emslive.com. I'm helping to author some stuff over there, as well as some other people on the web. If you're interested in writing for an EMS website and have some experience doing so, you might want to check it out yourself. You can apply to be an author over there. It's a great opportunity for you to share your comments and your learning with other EMS providers. So check it out, emslive.com. Listener Pam checked in and wanted to know a little bit more about how our friend Kelly out in California converted her EMS textbook into an audiobook. And I have put her in touch with Kelly, and they're figuring all that information out together so that she can do the same thing. But I also wanted to let the rest of you know that I took an opportunity when I was down at EMS Today to go and talk to all of the EMS publishers that were down there. And this is some of the information I found out. I spoke to somebody at Jones and Bartlett. I spoke to somebody over at the Brady textbook site. And I also talked to somebody at McGraw-Hill. And the question I asked was, you know, here's what Kelly did. What can people do to find more content? What kind of resources are available out there for students with these textbooks because they need more from their textbook? Couple of things came up. Everybody had slightly different packages and different offerings, but they all offer additional content at their websites associated with their textbook. A lot of textbooks now has like a scratch-off panel on the inside of the cover and or some kind of code associated with the textbook that gives you access to the website for 12 months or 24 months, some period of time associated with your learning process. And this gives you access to additional content and features. Many of them are now offering complimentary audio or video content or a combination of both. What I mean by complimentary content is it's not the full text in audio form. What it is, though, is after you've had your lecture, after you've maybe even just glanced through your chapter, this is going to be additional content to help cement that information in. It might be some kind of case-based profile of how to use some of the information you've learned dealing with patient care. It might be additional lecture information from the author of the textbook. I think one of the sites was offering a lot of that kind of content. So there is audio content out there that's available for download. In fact, a lot of this content is available for download, and you can actually look at it, listen to it, and then if you want, you can pay a small fee to get continuing education credit for it. So you can listen to it and access it. If you want continuing education credit, you can actually pay for that, similar to what you find in some of the articles in the journals. So that's one resource that I heard about. So I would urge you to check those, you know, those three or four pages right in the inside cover of your textbook, you know, the three or four pages that you flip past right away to get to the table of contents. Those three or four pages, a lot of time, contain valuable information on how to use your textbook. Read those things. Find out about some of this web-based information that you can use to supplement your learning. Find out a little bit more about what you can do to help yourself. And you may find that they have a lot more online that'll enable you to get this extra content for yourself. Also, something I found out, some of the books are offered in full text versions online. So you buy your textbook, you can also go online and find the full text of the textbook online. So what does that mean? Well, instead of doing what Kelly did and scanning everything, if you want to do it that way, you can go ahead online if your textbook offers it, and you can grab that text information from the full online version in chunks a little bit at a time. And you can use most computers now will allow you to actually speak that text. It'll have like a text-to-speech set up in your preference pane. Just go ahead and set it up, and you use that highlighted text or copy it into a text editor and have your computer read it back to you. That's one way to get that audio information out, and you don't have to go ahead and scan all the pages in and character recognize it. You can go through and have the computer read it for you. And you can also have your computer record the computer reading it to you. So you have a way to get that audio textbook that you're looking for a little bit easier than may have been available when Kelly first tried this a few years ago. Time to jump into this week's news. And you know, it's funny how things come around after a bit and seem to come full circle. I got an email from a listener, a couple of months ago, talking about the horrible shape of their ambulance fleet in their service and how they were breaking down and they were always worried about how awful it is. And this is a common theme that I get from many listeners on how they are working with equipment that's just falling apart, it seems like. So it's interesting when I get those emails in and then soon afterward, news starts cropping up about different problems with medic units breaking down during patient transports or even before they can get the patient started on transport. And this happened in Philadelphia over the New Year's celebration. A woman was involved in a severe respiratory distress and ended up dying because the initial ambulance dispatched to them actually broke down and couldn't transport and ran out of oxygen while waiting for the next ambulance to come. And ultimately, that person died. Not clear whether this next story is related to the death of the patient specifically, but in Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, a patient was waiting for transport in the middle of a massive MI, and the patient was loaded into the back of the medic unit and began to start the transport. The driver put his foot on the brake and shifted it into gear, and the complete vehicle went dark. Loss of power, nothing. And the supervisor suddenly realized and told the wife of the man that was having a heart attack in the back that they had no power and mechanical problems are something that they've been having a problem with this particular unit. And he actually said that to the woman. Then they had to wait for another crew to come, and they ended up transporting the patient to the hospital. Now, the patient was alive when he got to the hospital, and they went to the cath lab where they cleared a blocked coronary artery. However, the patient did ultimately die a few days later in the hospital. I think about 4 or 5 days later, the patient did pass away. And it's unclear whether the delay in transport, and it doesn't say how long that delay was or anything, but ultimately that delay in transport, did it have an effect on the patient's survival or not? They just don't say in the article over at emsresponder.com. But it does bring into question, what are you going to do if that happens? And, you know, as I always do with stories like this, I don't question the conduct of the providers involved. There's nothing to indicate there was any problem with their treatment here. It was a mechanical issue. And units are going to break down. Heck, I've had brand new units break down and cause issues. So that happens. But again, like Rick Rosati often says, my buddy Rick over at the Mitigation Journal podcast, talks about the rule of outcomes, planning ahead, using your knowledge now to think about what you do in a situation in the future. And so I would ask you, if you lost power in your unit, how are you going to continue treating a patient that may be in dire straits? Something to think about and something to plan for, at least as far as the way you think things through. Since I'm already in Ohio, I'll make a little bit of a turn and head on up to Cleveland. And for those of you that are in the Cleveland area, are you aware that Cleveland is bleeding staff? And I don't mean staff as in infection. I mean STAFF. They are losing EMS workers at a prodigious pace. They've lost 88 people in the last 2 years. They have lost 47 people in the past year. And this is due to the fact that they are moving to locations that pay more money and offer signing bonuses. And these providers are leaving that community and moving to greener pastures. And you know what? I can't blame them. We don't get paid enough as it is in the EMS community. Why should we be working extra work and not getting paid as much as we can get paid, you know, a couple hundred miles away, even more than a couple hundred miles away? It doesn't matter, you know, especially if I'm single, I'm out of there, right? Well, there's been some concern as the EMS commissioner in Cleveland still has 40 job openings. They've been unable to fill these positions, and it's beginning to be something that is concerning city council members who worry that their staff is going to continue to dwindle over time. They are worried about providing adequate care for their community. And I wonder, you know, about the rest of you that are in situations where you're working extra job, you're working extra hours, overtime, trying to make ends meet, and you're getting yourself worn down, and yet your service still can't fill the positions, and you're still required to work additional overtime and put those extra time in. I've talked to Chris Black about this. He deals with this kind of situation all the time and just wonders when it's going to stop. You know, when are we going to be able to put enough people in the seats? And part of it is, you know, if you pay a decent wage, you're going to get decent people and be able to hold on to them. I've known that and believed that for a long time. You know, Cleveland, I know it's a hard lesson to understand, but if you want a good, high-quality EMS staff, you need to pay for them. You need to compete with Memphis and Tucson and all of the other cities that are sucking away your talented, hard-trained EMS staff. You want to keep them? You're going to have to work to keep them. However, being willing to pay them may not be enough, as Philadelphia has found in the next news item. Philadelphia actually budgeted additional funding, $3.9 million, to increase the hiring and put more paramedics and more medic units on the street. And the fire commissioner and fire department there is still 31 paramedics short. They have the budget and money to hire 80 more paramedics, meaning that with his budgeted funding and his existing funding, this department can hire 111 paramedics if they could find them. Now, part of the thing is that the city has a residency requirement, and they can waive that for 1 year, but they do have to have some kind of a residency requirement. So that's always the thing that's going to hold people back, by making their city workers live in the city if they don't want to. But here's the other side of that picture. Maybe there just aren't any paramedics out there. I mean, maybe there are not enough people to go around, period, to fill all the empty jobs. And this is only going to get worse. I've talked about this over at the nursing show, where there is a pending nursing shortage. That same shortage and same staffing issue applies to every aspect of the medical care system, EMS, hospital, and otherwise. It's all a problem. So I'm interested to see how Philadelphia solves this problem. Part of the issue might be that they have the budgeting for these jobs, but they aren't paying enough for those jobs still. I mean, you know, 111 jobs, but if they're still not offering money per job, then they're not going to be able to compete. And maybe that's something they need to look at doing, is making it, you know, 80 positions and splitting the rest of the money up between those 80 jobs. They might be able to bring that pay scale up enough to be more attractive. I'll close out the news today with an item looking at comparing hospitals. So, Do you have an opinion about your local facilities? Is there a hospital you transport patients to that you wouldn't be caught dead taking a family member into? This is something that I think we all have opinions about. I know that I have patients that will tell me, no, don't take me to that hospital, take me to the other one. We live in a location where we're about centrally located to three local community hospitals. And so they're all about equal distance apart. And it's funny how on a given day, I can have patients back to back who will swear up and down that opposite hospitals are the worst place in the world and take them to the other place. You know, so you go and take one patient who doesn't want to go to one hospital and you take them to the other hospital and you come back and pick up another patient and they don't want to go to the first hospital. They want to go to the other guy's hospital. I mean, it's a mess. How do you really know, though? What kind of way of comparing? I mean, we all have our anecdotal stories, but what do we do when we want to compare these facilities? Well, the federal government, surprisingly enough, has come to our aid here. Health and Human Services at hhs.gov has a site that they have had available since 2005, and the latest version is now available. It is www.hospitalcompare.hhs.gov. And when you go to this hospital compare site, you can actually compare 2,500 U.S. hospitals according to how well they meet 26 Medicare performance standards. So you can kind of shop around, see what your local hospitals do and how they compare with each other on certain scales. This type of thing is also available for local nursing homes. So this is something that's pretty interesting, and I'm going to have to get on there and myself and look at this after I get done recording the show here, but I urge you to head over and check it out yourself. It's going to be interesting as hospitals begin to compare with each other on measures like admission for heart attack or heart failure, death rates of patients within 30 days of hospital admission. You know, it's interesting, but wouldn't you like to know how many places have patients die within 30 days after they walk out the door? Maybe that's not necessarily fair, but it certainly makes for an interesting statistic to talk about around the station house. So look at this story in the news and check out the link in the show notes. Also, head on over to hospitalcompare.hhs.gov. The news is done, and it's time to look at this week's tip and trick of the week. And actually, this week, instead of the tip and trick in the med, I've got a featured interview. I'm really excited to offer an interview here with our listener friend, Irk, from down in Australia in New South Wales near Sydney. And Irk is a dispatcher down there for emergency services. And a couple of months ago, I put out a call and said, hey, you know, I want to know a little bit more about how EMS works around the world. I talk a lot about how EMS in the United States works, and I know that based on how everybody else does things, we kind of have a different system here with our private medical system and no public health service. So I wanted to know a little bit more about how the emergency services system works in other parts of the world. And listener Irk chimed in to offer to help out and contribute to the show via Australia and talk a little bit about how things are run in New South Wales. And so, Irk, I want to thank you again very much. This interview was recorded, maybe a month and a half ago, and I finally got an opportunity to put it here on the Medicast. So Irk is also a podcaster. He does kind of it's kind of hard to explain how Irk's podcast is. You'll have to check it out for yourself at Irk, ERKpod.com. Head on over to IrkPod and you can listen to Irk's podcast. It's like a roundtable discussion show, I guess a mishmash of different topics and things that they discuss. It's a lot of fun and really and enjoyable to check out. So check out Irk's podcast. And he actually interviewed me after I got done interviewing him. So you can listen to his interview with me over at IrkPod.com. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I am here with Irk from IrkPod. And Irk is a volunteer dispatch supervisor, and I'll let him tell you exactly what his official title is here. But Irk, I will say good day to you down in Australia.
G'day, Jamie. How's things stateside, mate?
Well, a little chilly right now. I know it's summertime down your way, and you're near Sydney in New South Wales. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm about an hour's drive out of Sydney, right at the foot of the Blue Mountains.
Excellent, excellent. I'll tell you, one of these days, my wife and I, Australia is on our destination list for us to take a long vacation someday. And as soon as my kids are a little bit older, I think we're probably going to leave them with somebody and try to get away. So maybe in 3 or 4 years or a couple of years, we can get down. And I'll have to visit all of my listeners in Australia. I've got quite a few down there, which is wonderful. But you found the MedicCast podcast and volunteered to talk about the way your fire and ambulance services operate in the New South Wales, in the state of New South Wales. So why don't you start off with explaining exactly what your position is as a dispatch supervisor?
Sure. I'm a volunteer member of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service. And in my terms, I'm a communications centre supervisor. So basically, my role is to supervise a team of communicators when they receive radio calls and telephone calls from our fire appliances and also from the State Fire Command, who give us all the fire calls, and then we dispatch our units accordingly.
That's amazing, because it is completely alien to me to have a volunteer dispatch service. We're used to having volunteer fire companies of varying degrees of part-time or volunteer, and yet in your area, you also have volunteers serving in the dispatch capacity. And do you find that there's, just on a little sideline, do you find that it's difficult to maintain enough volunteers to staff that, or is there a backup paid dispatch center that assists you?
With our service, it's primarily volunteers. We do have staff. The way that our center operates is during normal business hours, we have paid staff running the dispatch center, and also they can supplement us if required. We mainly run the center on weekends when most of our fire traffic is, and also if required, if there's an extended emergency.
Wow, that's just amazing. So then a call comes in. First of all, what's the emergency access phone number for your region?
In Australia, the emergency number is 000. However, if you're on a GSM mobile, you can also access the service via 112.
Okay, that's good to know. And so, and you also said radio. Now, do people in outlying areas use radios as opposed to typical telephone or mobile phone traffic?
In my area, not so much. The radio is just between us in dispatch and the fire appliances, whereas in the outer areas, they also use it to talk to each other. And also, in some areas, they also use the radio to report fires to whoever's manning the radios in the dispatch center.
Okay, so a call comes in, and do you also dispatch your ambulance service, or does that go through a separate dispatch center entirely?
What happens is that someone will make a 000 call, and our Telstra, which is our phone provider, will ask which service they require, police, fire, or ambulance. As we'll discuss later, fire and ambulance or fire and EMS is totally separate here in Australia. If they ask for fire, they'll go through to the main communications centre in Sydney, and then if the fire is in there, in my area, the call will be transferred to me, and then I'll send whatever appliances I need to send.
Okay, so So the EMS goes, or the EMS, I should say, the ambulance, because that's what you call the service there is ambulance, it would go through a different call center and be dispatched out of their agency. But a call comes into you, it's a fire call, and you dispatch your appliance or what I would call apparatus, I guess. And you have this. Now, what services then respond? Is there a volunteer component and a paid component to your fire apparatus, or your fire appliances that are going out on the road?
It depends on where the call actually is to, because we have two fire services. We have the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, which is, as I said, mainly volunteer-based. And we also have in this area the New South Wales Fire Brigade, which in this area is full-time professional. So depending on the call, they'll go if it's their area, or we'll go if it's our area, or if we need their assistance, or if they need ours, we'll run on a mutual aid basis.
Excellent. So what kind of, in your region, what kind of call volume do you see? How many triple O calls do you get?
It varies because we'll only get the triple O calls that go to our area. If it's a New South Wales Fire Brigade area and they don't need our assistance, we won't get a call to it, so we don't have a way of knowing their calls compared to our calls.
But your particular dispatch center with your volunteers, how many calls do you all field on a monthly basis or over the course of a year? What kind of call volume do you see in your center?
It can vary because of the weather, because a lot of our calls are for bushfires or what you'd call wildfire. So it can vary. Our summer calls, we might get something like 10 calls a day, whereas in the middle of winter, it might drop down to one call a day. It varies a lot.
What do you see as the primary issue in your volunteer service with keeping and retaining volunteers? Is that a problem in your area? I see a lot of news items coming out of different parts of Australia looking at the volunteer services and coordinating and recruiting volunteers. Do you see that as an ongoing issue in your community? Because it certainly is something that's on the forefront of our thought process here in the States for volunteer services, is recruitment and retention of volunteers.
It's absolutely a vital issue, not just for us in dispatch, but also for the volunteer firefighters. There's a lot of training and skills maintenance that needs to be done even when you have the basic skill set. So there's a lot of time and a lot of dedication, especially for what we call our campaign fires that may go for 1 or 2 weeks or maybe longer.
So, and those are basically wildfires or brush fires in the outer regions, or is that something that encroaches on more metropolitan or residential areas closer to Sydney?
Where I am in Western Sydney, we're on what we call a rural urban fringe. So we have a lot of metropolitan, but we also have a lot of rural area that hasn't been built yet. So we could have a lot of bushfires that go for 1 or 2 weeks, especially in the mountains behind me.
Okay, and that sounds very similar to what we see in the wildfires that occur in the western U.S. A brush fire in my region, I think just because it's so wet on the east coast of the United States, tends to be very, very small. It's rare for any kind of brush fire or wildfire in this area to go longer than it would be unusual to the extreme to have something go beyond, say, 24 hours in time frame. But I know on the West Coast, they have wildfires quite frequently that last for weeks. But I can imagine how, that is taxing on your resources. Is there a mechanism to provide for any kind of compensation or time off from work when there's a situation that requires extended time in the field?
It depends on what sort of job you have. If you have a government job, you can absolutely take as much time off as you need in what we call a Section 44 or a state of emergency. However, if you're self-employed or you don't work for the government, it's up to basically the goodwill between yourself and the employer.
So much the same as we have here. And I think that's one of our issues retaining or recruiting new volunteers is, I think once upon a time it was very easy because of the way a lot of the rural communities operated here, and I'm sure in other places that have volunteer services, was that the that you know, the employer knew everybody else and it was okay to leave your job to respond to a fire call. But as services became busier and busier, employers were less apt to let that employee leave to go respond to a fire call. And so we've seen an issue during the daytime hours of keeping units staffed appropriately. So, and I don't know, is that something you've seen as well?
Absolutely. We do have issues in relation to that. We don't only travel within our local area. If there's another area that needs help, we could be away from our area for 72 hours up to a week as well, assisting the other areas in similar fire. So yes, it can be a problem.
So Eric, we talked about how your fire service is set up and the volunteer nature of your dispatch center. Can you talk to me a little bit about how your ambulance side is operated? They get the call in to the dispatch center, or to the phone service. It's routed over to EMS and they respond. Is that also partly volunteer or split service? How does that set up?
Here in New South Wales, it's 100% full time. However, in other parts of Australia, we do have volunteer ambulance in some of our regional and rural areas as well. So to use the example that I used before, if someone called in for a fire and there were people injured, the fire dispatch centre in Sydney would also contact the ambulance communication centre and then they would send through an ambulance to the location, because fire and EMS in Australia is totally separate. EMS is more towards the health system. It's all funded and translates through the health system, and fire is fire and EMS is EMS. They're not joined as they are in the States.
What about any kind of first aid or first responder training for your firefighters? Do they have anything beyond, say, basic CPR? Is there a first response capability on your units on the fire side, or do they rely entirely on ambulance to pick up that side of the care?
It depends on if we're talking full-time fire officer or if we're talking volunteer. In the volunteer side, first aid isn't compulsory, but you can get first aid qualifications and you can get qualifications so you can work an oxyviva machine, so you can give some basic oxygen therapy. Whereas with the full-time firefighters, they do have more of an understanding of stuff like oxygen therapy. But when it comes to anything else, it's mainly down to the ambulance service.
That's very interesting, because I know here in the States there is a national voluntary standard, and by voluntary I don't mean volunteer, but a standard that is set for firefighter status of training at a national level, so that's something you can aspire to and take with you as you travel and you move to different regions. And part of that standard includes a requirement to have a certain minimum level of EMS training. I think it starts at what we call first responder, which is a basic first aid training that includes oxygen therapy. And then the next step above that is actually requires EMT basic as the minimum standard, along with your firefighter one and additional training to go with your fire structural firefighting training. So that's very interesting, because here, even in the services where it might not be joined, there is still an EMS expectation on the fire side, at least a minimum level of training.
One thing that I will mention outside my state is in Melbourne, Victoria, they have a program between the Metropolitan Fire Brigade and also the Melbourne Ambulance Service. If there's a heart attack, for instance, there will be a dual response there, and the firefighters have training in relation to AEDs and able to provide that sort of assistance. But that's probably as close as we've got in Australia in relation to firefighters being EMTs.
And we've been talking about firefighting duties. What is the responsibility? Who gets dispatched for motor vehicle collisions? Do you have rescue units that respond from your fire appliances or from your fire service, or is that handled entirely by ambulance as well?
Rescue in New South Wales is a bit of an issue, depending on where the actual incident is. It could be done by fire as the primary, it could be done by ambulance, it could be done by the police, it could be done by two volunteer groups called the Volunteer Rescue Association and also the State Emergency Service. But each area has a primary rescue and also a secondary rescue.
Wow, that's very interesting, because again, and it's really amazing, and I really appreciate you getting on and talking to me, because it's been this is just a great education in how different things can be set up. And so you actually have a third service that may be involved in rescue in some regions that's completely separate from both fire and ambulance, and that's very interesting to me. And you said in some areas that actually police take care of rescue responsibility?
They have a dedicated police rescue squad.
Wow.
Where the officers are not only trained as police, but they're also trained as rescue operators in that particular area. Sometimes in some areas in the Blue Mountains, for instance, they rotate between the police being the primary and the fire brigade being the secondary, and they'll just rotate
and take turns. So that's very interesting. Well, Irk, I think that kind of covers anything. Is there anything else that we've missed or that I didn't know about that I should have asked about?
One thing that we're starting to get into is in New South Wales Ambulance, which is the ambulance authority that covers New South Wales, is that we're starting to have patient transport ambulances, who would be probably the equivalent of BLS, and they do inner hospital and inner facility transports. And then you've got your general duties ambulance, where you'd have emergency calls, and then also you'd have your paramedic above that, who'd be able to give drugs and all that sort of thing. But we are starting to see patient transport as a separate way of getting into the ambulance service. So you can join straight as a ambulance officer or a paramedic if you want, but you can also become a transport patient officer first. And we're also starting to see private ambulance services in relation to things like industries and motorsport and sporting events, where you can have another company provide the first aid of medical services first if you require them.
Okay, well, that's another growth of opportunities for people to get into that part of service, and that's very interesting. Do paramedics typically travel as a chase vehicle, or do they travel as part of a transport unit?
It depends on where they are. If you're in an urban area like mine, they'll usually come in the ambulance. However, we are seeing the start of a rapid response vehicle as well. In the centre of Sydney, where traffic congestion can be an issue, they even have paramedics on motorcycles. And I've had situations where in my job working on the railways, you'll have people, someone might collapse at a railway station or whatever, and then the first ambulance officer on scene might ride his motorcycle right up to the patient, assist the patient, and then call for extra transport if required.
And that's something I actually am a little familiar with. That was a featured article in the Journal of Emergency Medical Services here in the States. I can still picture the motorcycle and paramedic on the front cover. It was a big color, full cover illustration or picture of the photograph of one of the paramedics in Sydney on the motorcycle. And that was a fascinating article, because they went down the list of what they could carry in their saddlebags or, you know, the containers on the back of the motorcycle and how they were limited in the amount of space that they had. So that was a fascinating article. But that's something that, that hasn't quite come around here in the States, the motorcycle response unit. And it was some discussion after that article came out a few years ago about that. Well, Eric, I thank you very much. It seems like we've gotten a good picture, at least in your region, of basically how things operate. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share with the other Medicast listeners a little slice of how things are done in New South Wales, in Australia. Thank you very much.
No worries, Jamie. See you at the big ones and stay safe out there.
Thank you very much. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank Eric again for taking the time to chat with me via our Skype connection with Australia. It's wonderful to talk with Eric. And actually, I was able to, after speaking with Eric, to hook up with another listener, a burn nurse down in Australia nearby, that is going to be contributing to a segment over at the Nursing Show podcast, talking about the nursing programs in Australia and different ways that nursing is handled down there. So great opportunity. I really want to thank all of my listeners in other countries, and that means all of you in Australia as well. I really appreciate your support. And if you have something to add, don't hesitate to jump in. I've got a multitude of listeners that are very active in commenting here on the show. And I just want to thank all of you for checking in and supporting the Medicast. If you'd like to catch up with me here at the Medicast and send in your own comments, please feel free to do so. You can do that by checking in via email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also send me a voicemail if you'd like to. If you're on Skype or have access to Skype, you can do that and send it in to the Podmedic, PODMEDIC. Podmedic is my Skype handle. And if you want to call into that line directly, you can do so at 1-941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Don't forget, the Medicast forums are alive and well. I can't tell you how many great discussions are going on over there right now. It's just amazing to me. And it's one of the reasons I set up the Medicast forums. You know, it gets kind of hard when I have thousands of listeners checking out the show each week to get back to those everybody individually. And I try to do the best I can and return emails as quickly as I can and try to share some of the highlight emails here on the show. But you know what? There's a thriving community over at forums.medicast.com. Check it out for yourself. It's free to register. You can start conversations, contribute your own answers to somebody else's questions. Really a great sharing opportunity. You can upload video and photographs and all kinds of great opportunities for the Medicast community to work together and help each other out over at the Medicast forums. So, hey guys, keep up the good work over at forums.medicast.com. I'll wrap up the show with a song from one of the friends of the Medicast, a good friend, Matthew Ebel. Play a lot of his music here because, quite frankly, I enjoy it. He's got a lot of fun, little tongue-in-cheek humor involved in his music and just great tunes all the way around. This is his new song, Lost My Way. I've played it before on the show a couple of months ago, but it's time to play it again. This is Matthew Ebel's Lost My Way. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I want to remind all of you to remember, scene safety, PSI.
Doom, 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 hungover again. And I vow right now it's the last time I give in. So to commemorate, I'll go out and tie one on. I guess I'll quit drinking when you're gone. If I put off till tomorrow what I wanted yesterday, I'll just sit here till the future come and slap me in the face. If it don't change my direction,
and I float out here in space, then you can't say that I've ever lost my way. Well, I finally gave up smoking too. At least I thought that's what I told myself I'd do. Then in a cloud of smoke, my car moved to L.A. And my girlfriend got towed away. Well, if I put off till tomorrow what I wanted yesterday, come on, I'll just sit here till the future come and slap me in the face. If I don't change my direction and I float out here in space, then you can't say that I've ever lost my way. Well, I'll grab it with both hands. Lord knows I need a change of plans. And if I put off till tomorrow what I wanted yesterday, I'll just sit here till the future come and slap me in the face. If I don't change my direction and I float out here in space, then you can't say that I've ever lost my way. Then you can't say that I've ever lost my way.